learn about the figures who led our Misora. I use the word Misora very broadly on purpose. What I did in Toronto, actually, my last year in Toronto, I did a series called Giants Of. And that's sort of the predecessor of this. And I just said Giants Of because it was Giants of Halacha or Giants of Mefarshim or Giants of whatever it is. The figures who are our leaders, you know, throughout that period, to learn about them and through them to learn about the history of the time. You know, I should preface by saying I'm not a historian by any training. It's really just whatever I've picked up along the way, reading, learning. As we'll see eventually, we get to one of the sources. This is a great source. One of the early Ashkenazim was asked about a certain period in time. And he says, you know, I never really learned this in like a systematic way. I can just tell you what I've picked up from reading the Chuvos, reading the response. And this is someone like the 14th century saying that. And that's basically, you know, that resonated with me. Because that's you know, where that's my starting point. So we'll be doing some biography. We'll be doing some of the Torah of these leaders. And we're going to be starting with the period of the Gaonim. So call that roughly 7th to 10th centuries. But we're going to have to first orient ourselves in terms of, you know, what the Jewish world is, how it got there. But just, you know, out of curiosity, when we talk about Gaonim, which Gaonim are you familiar with?
Hi.
Rav Hai Gaon? Rav Sadia Gaon, Shrira Gaon.
One of them wrote Musa Sefer that we gave up on.
Pomeran?
Duties of the Heart?
No, he's later.
Oh, he's later.
Yeah, that Kobos Alevavos is...
That guy was too smart, too hard, we gave up on that.
Oh, boy.
But we finished others.
Okay, that's Rabbeinu Bachi Ibn Pekuda.
Rabbeinu Bachi Ibn Pekuda.
So he's later, he's 11th century.
Okay.
He's the end of that period. Okay. So, yeah, we'll be talking about the Gaonim who you mentioned. We've got a bunch more also to throw in. But let's talk about how the Jewish world got there. So Jews, even before the end of the second Beis HaMikdash, were all over the place. Huh. It's not as though we were all living in Israel and then the Romans came along, destroyed Yerushalayim, destroyed the Beis HaMikdash, and suddenly we were dispersed in the end of the first century Common Era. That's not so. As a matter of fact, I brought you a source here, and source number one. This is from Josephus. Remember who Josephus was, right? He was a general in the Jewish army against the Romans. He ends up surrendering to the Romans. There's a whole story involving how that happened. Was he a traitor? Was he not a traitor? There's actually an algorithm, which I had to learn in computer science, called the Josephus algorithm. The story goes that when he and his men were surrounded in their fortress, it was Masada style, and they decided that they were going to take their own lives rather than turn themselves over to the Romans. And the way the algorithm goes is you have to figure out, if everybody's sitting in a circle, figure out an algorithm such that each person ends up killing the next, but you can calculate that you're going to be the one to survive. The idea being his men all take their own lives, and then Josephus turns himself over to the Romans. Whether that has any bearing, you know, any basis in reality, I don't know. But they called it the Josephus algorithm. So he ends up, in fact, turning himself over to the Romans, and he writes a history, a lot of history actually, Antiquities of the Jews, Wars of the Jews, which is clearly meant to curry favor with the Romans and to make us look good with the Romans. So whenever you read Josephus, you have to know you're reading somebody with an agenda. That's true of historians in general, but Josephus certainly. So that, yeah, you just have to know that when you read him.
So he's not really writing it with the tact of trying to survive for himself. He's trying to help the Israel in the way he's writing it. He's
I mean, part of it is him. I think part of it is the Jews, whether that's selfish or not. Part of it is an angle of making us palatable to the Romans. He doesn't want the Jews to look bad. Right. I think that's true. So look at this piece from the Wars of the Jews. This, he records here a warning for the Jews about revolt against Rome. The warning is not his personally, it's from King Agrippus. The danger, if you revolt against Rome, concerns not those Jews that dwell here only, meaning directly in the center of Rome, but those of them which dwell in other cities also. For there is no people upon the habitable earth which have not some portion of you, the Jews, among them. You guys are everywhere, whom your enemies will slay in case you go to war. If you fight the Romans, Jews everywhere are going to be vulnerable. And on that account also, and so every city which hath Jews in it will be filled with slaughter for the sake of a few men, and they who slay them will be pardoned. So don't rebel against Rome, because it's going to endanger Jews who are scattered in communities everywhere. And this is Agrippus. This is before the Beis HaMikdash is destroyed, but before the end of the second Beis HaMikdash. So
talking about rebellion in Rome or in Israel?
So rebellion in anywhere.
Outside.
I mean, it could be rebellion in Israel, but it's going to cause the death of Jews anywhere in the Roman Empire.
He's speaking to who?
Oh, no, sorry. He's speaking to Jews in Israel. That is correct.
Okay.
Yeah, that's
right.
True.
And warning them about rebellion anywhere in the Roman Empire will have an effect on all Jews.
Exactly. That's correct. That didn't stop us, by the way. But but yes, that's the idea.
Bar Kokhba.
Well, Bar Kokhba was after the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed.
Right.
He's still Jewish. But the Jews had revolts after the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed for decades,
really?
Until the crushing of the Bar Kokhba revolt. The Bar Kokhba revolt is the last of them.
Ah.
Yeah. So, and that's the year 135.
Right.
So Jews, already in the period at the end of the second Beis HaMikdash, are living in, not just in Israel, but we know that there are populations. If you look at the map, this is 7th century, this map. I'm not focusing on all the arrows and everything else, but just using it to orient ourselves. So you have Jews living in the lands that are around Israel. You have a Yemenite Jewish community, I believe, already at that point. You have Jews off to the east in Persia, Babylon, that area at that point. You have a Jewish community, we'll see shortly, in Morocco that claims to be there, I think, from the 2nd century. Common era, that's post-Beis HaMikdash.
Which fled out of Israel as the Romans approached.
Or fled before that. Meaning, remember, that not all the Jews came back for the second Beis HaMikdash.
We know only 40,000.
So in the initial wave, 42,630 or 360, I always forget which number it is. That's the initial wave. But there are more that come with Ezra, several thousand more. And presumably over the period after it's initially established, you also get more, but it's not the majority of the Jewish people. The majority of the Jewish people remain behind in Babylon. And they travel. And as we're going to see when we talk about the spread of Jewish communities, they end up, for economic reasons or because of persecution,
right,
favoring certain areas over others.
So it's that Gaulus that then has, during it and after it, the dispersion in the known world at that point.
Yes.
That's when it happens.
But we know that the Jews who are in Israel are not all staying put. They were traveling, right? How many stories do you have in the Gemara recorded of the Tanoim traveling on boats? So sometimes they're going to Rome to negotiate with the Romans, but not every boat ride is that.
Right.
But it's not the relocation that occurs. I mean, yes, they travel, but did they, before the first Gaulus, did they relocate? That's what I'm asking.
Meaning before the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash?
Yeah.
So all we really know, that I can think of at any rate, is Shlomo does have, beginning of the first Beis HaMikdash, Shlomo has agents in other lands. Malachim describes how people were bringing back for him all sorts of, you know, special things, animals from different places, spices, and so on. So he has people who are, you know, stationed in different places.
Right.
He has armies in different places that are conquering things,
right,
you know, or that are trading.
Right.
So you definitely have a population, unclear how permanent it is, you know, to me at any rate. But you've got people in Ethiopia, you've got people in other lands, for sure around the Mediterranean, that you do have. Tanakh tends not to really talk about Jewish populations that are outside of Israel unless they are exiled populations who are being held captive. You know, but you don't see. I mean, the Nevi'im are by definition, as the Gemara says, Israeli, right? If a Navi has Nevuah outside of Israel, we need to understand how that happened. Yonah gets Nevuah outside of Israel because he's on a mission from God that started in Israel, like that kind of thing.
That's the issue.
Exactly. The default assumption is Jews are in Israel, and that's, you know, that's the focus.
But there was one.
Sorry.
Ariel.
So, like I said, whether Daniel is a Navi is subject to great debate.
Oh.
Abarbanel thinks he is a Navi, others think he's not a Navi. It's a fascinating discussion in its own right, but I don't want to get too far afield. But what we do know is during the second Beis HaMikdash, Jews clearly are found in different places. By the time you get to the 6th century, okay, when the Gemara, Talmud Bavli, is canonized, because going back to what you were asking before we started the shiur, the Jews who are living in Israel canonize Talmud Yerushalmi.
Right?
Talmud Yerushalmi is a misnomer. It's not really the Jerusalem Talmud. They're not living in Yerushalayim. They're further north. But nonetheless, we call it the Jerusalem Talmud. And those Jews who are living in Israel, you know, canonize this Gemara, which we're going to eventually need to talk about, somewhere in, I believe, if I remember correctly, 5th century Common Era. Let's go earlier. The Mishnah is canonized in Israel, in Sipori, right near the Kinneret, in the beginning of the 3rd century Common Era. The year 220 is the year when they closed the Mishnah. That's been in development for a long time. We're going to have to talk about that. We're not getting to it yet, but eventually we will talk about the canonization of the Mishnah. So that's when they closed the Mishnah. Then you have this period of a few centuries when debate, discussion, learning, more is being written down until you get to the Talmud Yerushalmi in Israel, and then eventually the Talmud Bavli in Babylon. The Jews who are in Bavel have access to the Talmud Yerushalmi. They know the Talmud Yerushalmi. That's, we'll get to eventually, why we paskin like the Bavli over the Yerushalmi. The Rif from Yitzhak Alfasi in the 11th century says, because we who are living now, the Chachamim who did Talmud Bavli had access to the Talmud Yerushalmi, and if they disagreed, it was for a reason. So they're told
it's much more refined, edited.
The Bavli is. Bavli. Much more.
Much
That's very
more
true.
Refined, it's like, much
well,
more
edited. I would edited is probably the wrong word to use for Gemara in general, because it's not edited in the way that we think of editing a book.
Right.
It has an order and a structure to it, but it's a very loose sense of structure, in the sense that discussions, as you know, if you ever learn Gemara, you know, you start here and you end up way over there, and you have three stories thrown in. So it's edited with a different sensibility than what you would do in editing something. But that's there's a lot to say about that and about the structure of the Yerushalmi. That's really a different shear, though. So by the time you get to the beginning of the 6th century, when the Bavli is canonized, your Jewish centers, your serious centers of population, I don't mean some scattered Jew who's off in China, but your centers of population are really around the Mediterranean, and your major communities are, number one, Israel. You still have a significant population there. Number two, Bavel, east of Israel, in what is today Iraq.
Iraq.
Yeah. The communities have names like Sura, Neher Da'a, Pumbedisa is Fallujah, Matamaxia. And then you have the Roman community, Rome, the Italian provinces. So that's, you know, don't look at what's shaded here on the map. I took this map from a different source, which you can see the heading, the website that I gave you. It's a map of Muslim conquests. So that's what all the arrows are about. The arrows are not where we are. The arrows are where Islam spread. There were also smaller communities, though. In the northern coast of the Mediterranean, starting from west and working our way east. So in the west, you have the Iberian Peninsula, Spain, Portugal, and they claim to have a community at least from the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash. I did find online, but I have to admit it was a Wikipedia page, and therefore take it for what it's worth. I didn't track down the source that they were quoting, but they claim that there is a second century headstone in Spain with Hebrew on it. We do know the Jews live under the Visigoths, who become brutal, and then the Muslims invade in the year 711, and that actually, for a while, improves things for Jews. We have to talk about that whole phenomenon, but that's not what we're getting to now. But you work your way east from there into the Anatolia area, which today is Greece and Turkey. You have Jewish communities also, at least from the time of the end of the second Beis HaMikdash, if not earlier. So you have in the west, right, the area that will become Spain, Portugal. You have in the east, the area of Greece and Turkey. And in the middle of it, you've got Italy, Rome, a major, major Jewish work. If you go further up from the Mediterranean into Europe, so I have heard of a community in Cologne from people who left Italy and traveled north, like north of, they crossed the Alps. But I don't know a whole lot about it. It seems to exist for some time.
In the second century?
Yeah. It seems to exist for some time because the record is that in 462, the city falls to the Franks, and that there are Jews who are there at that point, and that things actually got better for them at that point. According to the article that I read in the Jewish Encyclopedia on this community, I found another article, a German article, that doesn't seem to be as sure, and my German really isn't good.
They crossed the Alps to settle on the far side.
They settle in Cologne, yeah. According to the Jewish Encyclopedia, in the year 881, the Normans invade and they destroy the Jewish community at that point, and it is only rebuilt in the 11th century. We'll talk about Jews in Germany eventually, because that's a fascinating thing in its own right, and of course we're going to need to know about it in terms of the development of Ashkenaz. In terms of the southern coast of the Mediterranean, you know, North Africa, so again, working our way from west to east, Jews arrive in the western part of North Africa, the area that becomes Morocco, with destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash, and again with destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash. They come in waves. In particular, they come from Spain. When things are bad in Spain, Jews cross the Straits of Gibraltar, heading south, and end up in Morocco. So when the Visigoths are in Spain and things are terrible for the Jews, you find Jews fleeing south. There are stories, I think I mentioned it when I had the class, when we had the class on the Rif, we mentioned the that there are stories of Berber tribes adopting Judaism. That's based on the writings of a Muslim writer, Ibn Khaldun, in the 14th century, who made that claim. There's more when we had the shiur about the Rif. I talked about that. But that's the western part.
Now, when that happens, going from Spain to Morocco, they're basically retreating back to communities that they've seen, because the trek has to go across North Africa.
No, they're going south across the Straits of Gibraltar.
Well, that's how did they get there originally? Meaning those Jews that are in Israel
Spain. How did they get to Spain?
Yeah, they went across North Africa.
That would be logical, although I don't know for sure.
Unless they went through the seas.
That's what I'm saying. Maybe they went by boat. I don't know.
Okay.
Or they went overland in the north, meaning they could have come from Italy. Right? Jews who were exiled to Rome from Israel.
Exiled.
You know.
Can't get in chains.
Yeah. So they could have gone west, Spain. Right? That's just as doable. So I'm not sure of that. But as you work your way east along the North African coast, Kairouan was a major center for Jews, what is today Tunisia, in the middle of North Africa, and there are Christian writings from that area, from Carthage, that mention Jews in this period right after the second Beis HaMikdash. Egypt had a community, we know, in the times of the Mishnah and the Gemara, we talk about the Jews of Alexandria, and that seems to have continued as well. And then as you get into the Middle East, we have a tradition from Josephus of Jews living in Arab lands. And it's very unclear exactly what the political boundaries are between, you know, they don't have countries in the sense that we do, you know, today. But think Saudi Arabia, possibly Yemen, that area as well. So the Talmud Bavli, Babylonian Talmud, is concluded, as we said, in Babel, in Babylon. Think, you know, Iraq. By the start of the 6th century Common Era, I brought you the Gemara in source number 3, self-reporting. Rabbi Nassan Sof Mishnah, right? Rabbi and Rabbi Nassan are the end of the Mishnah. Rabbi Yehuda Anasi being the canonizer of the Mishnah. We'll have to talk eventually about that. Rav Ashi V'Ravina Sof Horah. Rav Ashi and Ravina are the end of Horah, Psak meaning the Psak of the Gemara. How exactly was the Mishnah canonized? What exactly does that mean? So what we're going to do eventually is get to a document called the Geres Rav Shri Ragon. a letter written by Rav Shvira Gaon. That is a document of monumental importance for anyone who wants to know anything about the Jewish history of this period, because the Jews in Kairouan, in the yeshiva in Kairouan, that community, wrote away to Rav Shvira, asking him a bunch of questions about our Masorah, about our tradition, wanting to know things like, if the Mishnah is recording all of these debates of the rabbis, why is it that the names that are in the Mishnah are all from like the last couple of generations of Tanoim? Who were everybody else before that? How did Machlokes develop? How is it that we ended up with disputes? Why didn't we just know what the halacha was? It was passed down generation to generation. So why didn't we know what we were doing? Like, very fundamental questions about Masorah. So Shri Ragon writes this document intending to answer those questions, and it'll give us more insight into the closing of the Mishnah. But I wanted to show you source number 4 from Rav Elchanan Wasserman. Rav Elchanan Wasserman, we know, was killed in the Holocaust. So he's writing, you know, relatively recently on the scale of Jewish history. But he says, you want to understand how the Mishnah was canonized? He says it was kibbutz kochach ben Yisrael o ruban b'chol makom shehem heim beis din shall call Yisrael me'elayen. He says, when you gather all or most of the chachamim, of the sages, they become the beis din for all of the Jewish people. And he says, Alein Umra Torah, regarding them, the Torah says, Ela Shofeta Shirya Bayamim Ahem. When you have a dispute, you go to the judge in those days. So if you have a court of all of the sages, or most of the sages of Israel, that's who they are. And he says, Chasimas HaMishnah Haya Gamkin B'Kibbutz Kochach MeYisrael O Ruban. He says, that's how the Mishnah was concluded. Don't think that it's Rebbe sitting in an attic somewhere writing stuff down. He says, no. Rebbe gathers together the Chachamim, all or most, Asher Lahen HaKarach Shal Beis Din HaGadol, and they had the power of the Beis Din HaGadol. Va'asar L'Shum Adam Lachlok Aleihem. And he prohibited for anybody to dispute, to disagree with them. Bilti im yesh gam lahachok in koach shal Beis Din HaGadol. Unless you find a new group that has the power of Beis Din HaGadol, enjoy. But barring that, it's...
Those who qualified from Israel?
So he was in Israel. He's in Tzipori. He's in Tzipori, correct. So this is... It's not gathering from afar, because your major yeshivos are Israeli at this stage. So yes, it is a gathering which essentially freezes the Mishnah. Then you have the Gemara, and the Gemara again is supposed to have been, you know, sealed in this way, but not quite in this way. And the reason I say not quite in this way is because we have a period after the conclusion of the Gemara, after this, and you know, the beginning of the 6th century. A period known as the period of the Savoraim. Savoraim, not a familiar term. Okay, Savoraim, Svara, is an idea.
One century.
So, well, it's the lines are blurry, as we'll see in a second. The lines are blurry. The job of the Savoraim is that they resolve outstanding issues in the Gemara itself, so that the Gaonim write and the Rishonim write that the Savoraim actually inserted things in the Gemara. The Gemara that we have is not quite what they had in the beginning of the 6th century. There were things that the Savoraim actually did in terms of editing. This I brought you from Rav Shvira Gaon in source number 5. Note, he's going to give you certain years in this source. The years are based on the Seleucid era. There's something the Gemara talks about called Minyan Shtaros, the count that appears in legal documents, and they used that in Babylon, in Babel, in the times of the Gemara. It's not counting from Alexander's death. It's counting from the start of the Seleucid Empire in Syria, and you use that for legal documents. So that's what he's counting from when you'll see his years. So look at what he says, and you can see, I brought you my English translation on the other side, but this is where he talks about Rabbanan Savoroi, a.k.a. the Savoroim. He says, Ubasar Haki, after this, meaning after the conclusion of the Gemara by Ravina and Ravashi, Avagav devadei ho-ra'a lo-havas, granted that they were not poskim in the sense that the Amoraim were, Havu savoroi de mefarshi perushi de mikrevila hora vikri inu rabbanan savoroi. They were still explaining things in ways that were close to psach, to this kind of groundbreaking establishment of halacha, and they were called rabbanan savoroi. That's what we named them. V'chol ma'ida havatali v'koi parshuha. Anything that was outstanding that had not been resolved, they explained it. Kigon Rav Rechumi, Rabba, Rav Yosef, Rav Achoy Mibechasim. He made names, certain names of Savoroi. Da'amrina, but maybe Geba Medina Sayam, V'tzikleg v'chulei. L'ubechasim, he ir besvivi Neherda. He mentions this place, Bechasim, and he says that it's around Neherda in Bavel. V'rav Ravoi Mirov, the Mefarish B'Mesach HaSanhedrin. He references where in the Gemara you see these communities mentioned. V'gam rov iro shel rav ravoi haisa besviv yeshivas ner dahi v'ami rabbanon de rav ravoi gaon hava v'orach shanei tuva. There's some discussion about this rav ravoi, whether he was one of the savaroyim or whether he was one of the gaonim. The lines are blurry. There's no one standing there, you know, with a calendar and saying, okay, this is the Amoraic period, this is the Savoraic period, and this is now gaonim. The best you can do is you do know that the Gemara is concluded with Ravina and Ravashi, so that tells you, okay, until now you're an Amora, after that you're not an Amora.
But wouldn't it be delineated by the fact that anybody who was named a Savora, so one from the Savora, he would have actually put pen to paper on the Gemara itself, whereas a Gon would not have done that?
So we likely can think that, I mean, it makes sense to say that. The problem is that we don't have a lot of documentation to work with in terms of the names of the people involved, what they did, and when they did it. Rishvira is really like the best resource that we have, and you don't have a whole lot beyond that. They weren't writing. You know, that's really important to know. We'll see more about that because we're going to have to discuss why the Gaonim start writing. Why do they start publishing halachic works?
The Gemara is still oral?
No, the Gemara is written down,
right.
But you're not writing down general texts. It's rare. You do have some written texts that are not Gemara in the period of the Gemara. So the Gemara talks about kosvei brachos, people who would record tefillah of some kind. But they don't say that in a positive sense. We find the Gemara makes reference to Megillas Starim, hidden scrolls, where Rabbanan would write down certain things that they wanted to remember. But they hid them away because you weren't supposed to publish Torah Shebaal Peh.
Right, but I'm speaking within the text of the Gemara. Anybody who makes an edit on a Gemara is going to be named as one of the Savorim.
Anyone who makes an edit on the Gemara, yes, that makes sense.
You just don't know who they are.
But
just don't know
who. Rav Shrira does know some. You'll see. Rav Shrira is going to name some. So take a look. He says, "Vekama svari ikbu b'Gemara." De'inun me'rabanan basroi. He says, some ideas were put into the Gemara that come from later rabbis, kegon Rav Eina, Rav Simuna, v'naktinan min harishonim, de Gemara de'ishaniknes begimel drachim, de'taninim bereisha, menan imili ad bekesef menalan, kulu inach peruke v'kushe de'mitzaritzi begemara. This is a classic. The opening Gemara in Meseches Kiddushin is considered to be from the Savoraim. It's where they talk about the methods of Kiddushin and how you know the methods for betrothing. Betrothing isn't really the right word, but there is no English parallel to Kiddushin. But how you know that Kesef works, that Shtar works, all of that is actually inserted by the Savoraim. Rabbanan Basroi Savoroi Tartzinu V'Kavinu. They're the ones who explain these things and put them in the Gemara. Veruba de Rabbanan Savoroi Shchivu B'Shanim Mu'atos. And he says, you asked, is this a one century era? So he says, if you're following in the English, it's where it says 107. He says, most of the Rabbanan Savoroi died in a short time. That doesn't mean they died young. It means that there was a brief period. Da'achi Pershu Gaonim B'Sifrei Zichroneim B'Divrei Hayamim. He says, this is what I found in the chronicles of the Gaonim. Bishnas Taf Tezvav, in the year 815, which is 504 in the Common Era, Rav Shachiv Ravna Sama Brei de Ravna Yehudoi Besivan, V'amrin de Dayana de Bavahava. So Ravna Sama, the son of Ravna, died in the month of Sivan, and he was, like I translated there, the judge of the gate. And then they go on to say, B'chad B'Shava on a Sunday, which was the 4th of Adar, the Rav Achoy Bar Rav Huna died. And so on. Rav Rachumoy, Rav Shmuel Bar Yehuda from Bedisa, Ravina Bar Amutsia, Rav Huna Reish Galusa. We'll talk about the position of Reish Galusa. We have to come back to that. Rav Achoy Braid the Rav Bar Avua, Rav Tachna, Mar Zutra, the sons of Rav Chinina. And then he says, V'ishtayer Rabba Yosef Gaon b'misivtin kimem shnin. Rabba Yosef remained the Gaon in our yeshiva for 40 years. We have to talk about the term Gaon and what exactly that means. Ubasar Hachi Rav Eina b'Sura. Then Rav Eina was the Gaon in Sura. We're after the Savoraim. Rav Simone in Pumbedisa. Ubasar Hachi, and then Rav Ravoy Meirov, Umin Mesifta, Dilan Hava, he was from our yeshiva, Va'amrin de Gaon Hava, and they say he was Gaon. We need to know again what that means.
All these people mentioned, we have texts from them, or we just know
no,
them by name?
No, we do not.
By name.
There were chronicles that recorded their names. That's all we know. Yeah. So the Jews in Bavel at this point are living under a government known as the Sasanians. The relationship between the Sasanian government and Jews are rocky. There were periods of harsh decrees. There were even government-instigated pogroms against Jews. In the 6th century, the Sasanians actually closed the yeshivos for a period of time.
When did the Romans have rule?
So this is farther east.
Yeah.
This is further east. This is further east. I mean, it's not, in any case, this is after the fall of Rome.
What was Rome?
Anyway.
Rome had no dominion in the east?
In Bavel?
Yeah.
I don't think the Romans ever take Bavel.
Constantinople, they went north.
Yeah, okay, so I don't think the Romans ever take Bavel.
So at the time of the Roman conquest, when there were still communities in Bavel, right?
Yeah.
It's just starting. So who are the governments?
So,
is it this government that you're referring
so
to?
Here's where I get confused, and I'm saying outright that I'm confused, because you see Persians referenced, but I don't know if that's the same Persian, or it's just the area that had been. You see Parthians referenced, and that always confuses me. And then you have the Sasanians. So the answer is, I don't know.
Right.
But
at this period, then, you say...
The Sasanians are the governing body there. They closed the yeshivos. Yes, in the 500s. The yeshivos are reopened in the year 589. And that is when Rav Shmira Gaon says the period of the Gaonim begins. You want to know when the Gaonim start? 589, the reopening of the yeshivos. Clear? That's the idea. So... I'm going to have to stop with that because of the Levaya that I have to get to. But God willing, we'll pick up with that next Sunday.
Oh, yes.
Okay.